You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to You Can't Say That. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and I'm speaking with Dani Repshar, author of Woke Supremacy.
You know, it's been interesting to talk to people who are working for these institutions while I was putting this essay together, because as I was reading these books, the responses I would get are, you know, oh, I should read that, you know, but what they meant is, oh, like when I have free time, when I'm at home, I will read this for me, but I could tell that what they did not mean is, let me figure out what this actually means for my work. You know, like let me know more about what racism looks like for my life. But it is separate from how we carry racial bias at work. And this particular essay that you mentioned that was written in HowlRound. I think it is about naming racial bias in our workspaces. And I think that is the first step. The second step is engaging.
Naming it. I think we've all named it. We know it's there. Like, you know, most of the institutions are run by one melanation.
But I think what's important is that white people are naming it in other white people, because these institutions are, the meetings that happen that keep these organizations are running are still predominantly white.
Well, but that's because the resources come from there. Like I sat on an advisory board for an organization, and we had a meeting about raising money. And the bottom line message was, people give money to people they know. So if you're going to an organization and asking for a grant or for some funding, they're going to go to everybody in their organization and go, do you know them? Do you know them? And if you don't have a relationship with somebody, they're just not going to give you the money.
Right.
So since the resources are predominantly in the hands of people who are non-melanated, the resources are going to keep going to those people unless you have someone who exceptionally is deciding, I'm investing in something else. And generally, it's an investment.
Right. But once you have that money, it's about, I think you're still having to figure out what to do, what you're putting on your stage, and how you are hiring. And I think those are the conversations that I'm talking about, where we have to. So, okay, for instance, I was having a conversation with a human resources director who was working with a hiring manager in a department to hire an entry-level position. And this human resources director made the effort to take a look at, to present the hiring manager with as diverse a body of candidates as possible. And then she presented this portfolio of candidates to the hiring manager and said, now you choose the best candidate. And you don't have to guess that this person chose two overqualified white women. from this diverse body of candidates. And she was saying, what do I do? Because this hiring manager is saying, well, we can keep looking for non-white women, or we can fill this position. And I think that that is, it's those moments where, you know, this person is hiring a very trainable job. These people are coming from, you know, they have 18 apprenticeships at, you know, all of the major institutions. And so we think, well, we have to go with the best candidate, but what we're not naming is that what we mean by best candidate is the white candidate that's going to make us feel comfortable. And I think it's naming racial bias in those instances and going to the hiring manager and saying, no, we have to keep looking because the diversity of perspective that a non-white, non-female will bring to our staff will far outlast the experience at Roundabout that this person is incorporating into this workforce.
I definitely agree with you about that. But I think that that is that the step of, hey, did you happen to notice that you had this pile of six people and yeah. of the six, there were four that were, you know, non-white and you happened to pick the two white. I mean, is it an accident? Were you even aware that you did that?
Right.
What happens if we pull them out? If we pull them out of the pool, who are you going to pick?
Right.
Let's go with those. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I do think you got to figure out, you know, how do you not shame the person who's done it because they also are biased and unconsciously and don't know. But then that's another uncomfortable conversation. It's uncomfortable for the HR person to have to call out, I guess, their boss about something like that. So it's, for me, it's so much about learning to be to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
It's true. And I think there are organizations and consulting professionals that are doing this kind of anti-racist facilitation with arts organizations.
Is it anti-racist or is it just pro-humanist?
Yes, agreed. But I think we have a ton of language that sort of fosters awareness. And I think that is the kind of work that these consulting organizations are doing inside organizations so that you don't have this uncomfortable dynamic between two people where one person is naming racial bias and the other person is saying, I don't agree with you or, you know, or whatever. But it is giving everybody language to identify it for themselves.
Yeah, language. Language is so complicated because words mean different things to different people.
Yes.
And, you know, you can read a book or you can Twitter about something and it doesn't really change things. I feel like it is definitely about uncomfortable communications between people that are like right now, like two people crunchy, crunchy, crunchying together till they can come to an agreement to disagree even.
Yeah.
One of the challenges I have with my students often is I want them to work on Alex Wilson because I think it's classic material.
Yeah.
And they will say, well, you know, that would be misappropriating and people would be mad at me because I'm like, you're in school. You're paying a lot of money. This is some of the finest language in the world. You should want to sink your teeth into this. And there's still total resistance. And I'm like, instead of you making a choice to do something that you think is going to avoid an uncomfortable situation, why don't you try to engage with the person who is challenging your ability to do this supposedly racist thing and say, what is it about it?
Mm-hmm.
Because what really is needed is for people to go deeper, and you got to go through discomfort to get deep. I mean, I personally risk all the time asking people what their ancestry is. I try to frame it not like asking you, where'd you come from? Because you could be from America. But what's your ancestry? Because I'm curious. And I'm willing to step my foot down my throat for the sake of having a deeper, real connection with somebody. Because if I've already messed up and, you know, insulted them, they get to call me on it. And I'm already in a vulnerable place.
Yeah.
And so I can be open. It's something I consciously do.
Yeah. Your point about the way that we sort of avoid these conversations, I see it also in the way that we in the casting decisions that we're making about how we're representing our stories on stage. And I think what I've noticed is that people just don't want to make a mistake. You know, they want it's less about having a vision for a particular show, and it is more about how do we not step in it? you know?
Right. It's about avoiding messing up, avoiding looking stupid, avoiding being ashamed. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, like we are the arts, we are the artists, and we have to be the tastemakers. Somebody has to be a tastemaker. Somebody has to.
Why does somebody have to be a tastemaker?
I don't know what else we're doing in our artistry if we are not giving something for people to look at. If we don't have a vision for the art that we are creating, I'm not sure what it is that we're doing other than, you know, engaging in a capitalist structure to make money in the arts.
Well, that's one thing you're doing, but you're also preserving your culture as the standard culture and making sure it's going to continue on as the normalized culture.
Maybe
that's
true.
About sustaining a legacy.
Yeah.
As opposed to disrupting your legacy.
But the problem is that the culture is changing. And so how adaptive are we to staying sort of on the front lines of how the culture is changing?
Well, I think of that with West Side Story. And, I loved West Side Story and the fact that Ivan Van Hove is, to me, acknowledging the fact that we are a screen culture. Mm-hmm. We're a screen culture.
That's true.
And so he is merging screens and live theater because that is the future. And if you want to get younger people in the room, because the people who've traditionally, you know, kept Broadway afloat, you gotta recognize the screen culture.
It's true. And I heard about there were people who were complaining. They got to their seats and watched the first act, and they at intermission they went. Is there an intermission?
No intermission.
At some point, they approached the box office staff, and they were like, "I can't see everything that's happening on stage. You should have told me this was partial view. I shouldn't be paying a full price ticket." And you know, the conversation was like, "No, you're seeing exactly what you're supposed to see." But you're right. I think the experience is on the stage, and the experience is in the room, and we are commenting on a culture that is changing. I look forward to seeing it. I haven't seen it yet. Oh. My husband has seen it and he loves it.
I loved it. I've seen it twice and spontaneous standing ovation every time.
That's so cool.
But it's definitely not the West Side Story of Natalie Woods that I certainly grew up on. It's not that. And I think that what is exciting to me about that production is that I think as a European, he's making a comment on American racism in that he's taken it instead of it's, you know, white people and brown people. He's saying it's Americans and immigrants and letting Puerto Rico be an immigrant, you know, as if that's not America. And the actors all look just alike.
Yeah.
You know, they look alike. So it's just people who look just like the same people attacking each other. And that is what I love about that production.
Yeah. And it's causing a lot of controversy too, but to your earlier point, I think we have to engage in the discomfort of what this play is bringing about. And there is no one answer to how to have an experience at West Side Story. And I think people want one way to think about this, and there isn't, because a lot of people are having a really profound experience in that theater. But we should also be taking to task the people in power who are making decisions that are making people feel excluded from that theatrical experience. And I think it's all part of the same conversation. But to your point, I think we should be moving towards the discomfort of that conversation so that we can actually have real conversations about it, as opposed to saying, well, I guess I don't like it because they cast, you know, this problematic person.
This problematic person. I guess I know what you're talking about, but we'll be discreet about what that is. How old are you?
I just turned 30 last week.
Oh, you're not a Gen Z, are you?
No.
What are Gen Zs?
I don't know where the cutoff is.
Oh, Alan's going to find out for us where the Gen Z is, but you're not a Gen Z.
No.
So I got three questions for you.
Yeah.
Gen Z is a group of kids, teens, and young adults roughly between the ages of 7 and 22.
Mm. Oh, okay. So I got a couple of Gen Zs, and my children are Gen Zs. Here's three questions.
Yeah.
Who are you? What is needed? And how do you serve?
Mm.
Who are you?
My name is Donnie Repscher. I guess the American way to answer that question is to respond with what I do. I am a professional fundraiser. I work in the arts. I work specifically in theater. I fundraise with individuals as opposed to with foundations, and so I have a particular responsibility as an ambassador on behalf of the arts institutions I work for to frame what it is that is valuable about this work. And I really enjoy being in that position to have conversations about this is why this work is meaningful and to meet people at that same intersection, to hear people share why this work is meaningful to them, because you know I work at New York City Center, and our most popular musical theater program is called Encores, and we revive Golden Age musicals. Any musical that we've presented, at least while I've been working there, is the first time I'm seeing the show, and it's the first time that I'm really ever knowing anything about it. And so it's difficult sometimes to be the people that I'm meeting have a profound experience because they were around when the show originated. And so I'm doing a lot of listening in this current role and framing why the artists are coming together to revive this piece at this time. And the answer is always because, you know, first and foremost, because there is this fabulous Encores orchestra playing the music like you would never hear it otherwise, because it is commercially unviable.
What's needed?
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What is needed? My mind is spinning because I think as it pertains to our industry, I think a through line, at least for this conversation, is that I think what is needed is to be more engaged in the things that make us uncomfortable, because what we're doing is the shells between the identity that we've constructed and the rest of the world are starting to rattle, and I think once we start sort of piece by piece taking these shells away and engaging in what it is that is making us uncomfortable, suddenly we have access to the rest of the world, and I think that's how cultures move forward, and that's how we expand as human beings.
Agreed. How do you serve?
I think I'm still figuring that out. I think, you know, so I've life lasts a long time, God willing, and I've served in a number of capacities. I got an acting degree in college. I moved to New York City because I knew that live theater was where I wanted to make a living. I started a development career 5 years ago, and I'm very grateful for the experience that I've had. And the end of my master's work was to write something that I feel very proud of, and I feel like is tapping into something that I would also love to explore about how to communicate in this way, and how to put ideas of mine and a perspective of mine into the community in a new way. And so I don't quite know the answer to that question.
Okay.
But it is about sort of moving forward. Yeah, that's what I got.
So listening to that, a question that came up for me, you said you raise money from individuals. Yeah. So just, you know, what do you think? If I, just yeah, not Tonya Pinkins, drink. Tony Award winner, you know, my brown being has to talk to these individuals. Are you in person or are you on the phone?
It's both.
So my brown body, are they going to give me money like they're going to give you money?
Are you... In this situation, are you the artist in the show?
No, I'm you.
You are
I have
me.
Your job, but I'm brown and I'm a woman.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I do a lot of my job is about making people feel comfortable.
Mm.
It's been an interesting moment at City Center because we are undergoing a leadership change.
Mm.
Lear DeBusschere is taking over for Jack Vertel in the Encores program, and Lear is asking a lot of critical questions about what it means to present these musicals today. That you know, that Encores originated as a concert series, and the level of production is increasing in such a way that we are basically presenting full productions and therefore have to stand behind full productions of musicals that don't have the language that we have today. And yet there are people who are our largest supporters who want to experience them the way that they did however many years ago.
Right. And they want a nostalgic experience. That's what they're paying for.
Yeah. And so it's been, we've had a lot of conversations about what it means to ask critical questions in this way. And a lot of the responses I'm hearing are, why do you, like, the world is changing, but musical theater shouldn't have to.
Ooh.
And... that's a hard thing to you know, to that's a hard space to enter in at like 10 a.m. on a Monday morning when people are, you know, you're calling someone to renew their Encore subscription. But the most concise way that I've been able to present this is that all we are trying to do is make people who otherwise felt excluded from a piece of theater feel more, we're inviting them into the room. But the thing that you love about the score score is the center of the theatrical experience, at least we're creating at City Center. That is the thing that you can come in and get to relive.
Yeah, but like Oklahoma, there's no black people. Why do I have to go see Oklahoma with black people?
Yeah. I mean, yes. Yes to all of
that. Well, come on, convince me to renew.
No, but I don't want to make light of it because it takes a lot of work and it takes, I
want to know how you do it.
Well, it's hard to be hypothetical about Oklahoma because I've only seen it once.
And I've never seen it at all, but I mean, I know it's got black people in it.
Yeah, but the first experience I had was actually this production when I saw it at St. Anne's. And it threw me for a loop, honestly, because I feel like I was having to watch both versions of the show. I was having to watch the Oklahoma as it's historically been presented, and then I got to see sort of all of the of Daniel Fish's sort of interpretive elements to this piece. And so all that to say, hypothetically, I don't know how to engage about Oklahoma specifically, but
here, I'm going to say something specifically. There's very few places in America where there weren't some other people of color, Asian people, Mexican people. So, I mean, isn't it arguable to say that, well, when they made that show and they didn't have any other people in it, that was a fake world.
Yeah, right.
The world actually of that play didn't exist. But, you know, like Woody Allen's New York doesn't have any people of color in it for the most part. That New York doesn't really exist. Maybe it does for him. Maybe he gets to isolate himself. But is that an argument that would work? Or they'd be like, nah, they don't care about that.
Right.
They just want their memory.
Right. Yeah, the responsibility we have as theater makers is that we don't, the movies live in the, we are seeing what they made when they made it. And that is the artifact that persists indefinitely. But when we are As theater makers, we are creating something that an audience will come in with. Their ears are set to 2020. Their ears are not set, and their eyeballs are not set to in the time in which it was written. And so we have a responsibility to meet our audiences at them and ask questions like this. If a piece was not written with any people of color and we choose to present it, I think we have to ask, are we staying true to that, or do we have an opportunity to think at a higher plane and say, how do we tell the story for what it means, for how it could resonate in 2020 in the New York City that we know?
So here's the tough question.
Let's go.
You know, I feel like there's a sort of ease that can happen to take a show and put it in a lens where people are homosexual. We're about to see it in Company.
Yeah.
But I think that that's because the people with money and power tend to be white male homosexuals who could either be out or be in,
yeah.
But they're in positions of power so that they can say yes to that. And they could say yes and still stay in the closet.
Yeah.
But the point to me is that if people who are Asian or Native American or Mexican or what other South Asian don't get to be in those positions of power, they can't push through art that reflects other cultures that they're aware of or even a part of.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You might have to lose your job.
What's the question?
Somebody might have to take your job.
What's the question?
Somebody might have to take your job, but you're saying I might not be able to get the money like you can get the money because I can't make people comfortable.
I see. someone might have to take my job as a fundraiser or as someone making artistic decisions.
Yeah, as making artistic decisions. Somebody else might have to take your job.
It's true. Listen, I think we are long overdue for a great reckoning. I am fully on board.
But does that mean that all the money's going to collapse? Because we're going to like, well, if the theater isn't going to look like what I remember or what I want to see, I'm not giving you my money. So there's not going to be any theater.
I say, how exciting. Yes. Let's. A friend of mine, we joke, it's like, burn it down, start all over. You know, I think... yeah, I think we've got a lot of work to do, and we could either fix our institutions from the inside, and you know, if history is any precedent, it's going to take a very long time. But yeah, what does that look like to start again? I mean, you know, I don't foresee that happening, but I'm interested in having that conversation because I think it touches on the truth of what it is that we're up against.
And what is your best hope before we burn it down?
I don't know. I think we start listening to the geniuses that are around us. You know, the people who are pointing towards change that we don't yet have a framework for. I think we start listening to them. And
historically, geniuses don't get listened to till after we've killed them.
It's true. So burn it down. Burn it down.
Damn,
start
that Galileo
again.
Was right.
Yeah,
that right. Copernicus was right.
Yeah.
Donnie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
for
you.
Having this conversation with me.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Tanya Pinkins. And you can't say that.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and You Can't Say That is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, with music by Kat Dale. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe and rate this podcast highly wherever you stream. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Tanya Pinkins. And to learn more, visit bpn.fm/YCST. Stay safe.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.